The Church at Ross Bridge is a bridge to belonging, believing, and becoming in Jesus Christ. We hope you enjoyed this message and visit our website at rossbridge.church.
Marcus and Sarah Carden, my father's parents, lived in Millbrook, Alabama. And like many of you, I have so many good memories of visiting my grandparents' home. Part of what's kind of seared into my memory is that there upon the orange shag carpet and hanging in front of the dark wood paneling was a grandfather clock with two religious pictures, one on either side. One was Jesus kneeling to pray over a large rock in Gethsemane, a beam of moonlight coming down and striking him as he prayed fervently. But the second was this one. My father just passed it along to me. Probably a familiar image to some of you. I think it came standard in any home bought in the 1950s. Jesus as the good shepherd. There he is with his shepherd's crook in his left hand, and in his right hand he's cradling a lamb and looking caringly down at the little lamb. I noticed that while this is not a famous art piece by a Renaissance artist, that there are details that the artist left in there. You have in the right hand part this little sheep here who's just looking up. She's smiling, and maybe that's her lamb that Jesus is holding, but she looks like a very loyal and well-behaved sheep that really loves her shepherd. And over here is Nathan. He's got horns and kind of a stern look on his face and doesn't seem aware that there's a shepherd at all. I'm going to hang this, I think, in my new office when we move across the street into our new building. That image comes from John chapter 10 that we're looking at today. Our series, Behold, is taken from an exclamation that John the Baptist makes about his cousin. John the Baptist is teaching and baptizing in the heated valley of the Jordan, and he sees his cousin cresting the hill and coming towards him. And so he directs the entire crowd around him, look, and pours all the attention back on his cousin and says in chapter 1, verse 29, behold the Lamb of God, who does what? Takes away the sin of the world. That's the way that Jesus enters the historical narrative in John. And as kind of a juxtaposition to that statement about Jesus being a lamb, here in John 10, Jesus describes himself as a shepherd. Now, part of what is important if you're studying the Gospel of John is that across the 21 chapters, John uses two different pairings of the number 7. The first pairing are Jesus' 7 signs or 7 miracles, like Jesus breaking the bread and feeding the multitude or Jesus raising Lazarus. Those are all signs. But he also gives 7 sayings where Jesus is making a proclamation about his own identity. Here's a list of them. And beginning in chapter 6, he says, I'm the bread of life. Then he goes on to say, I am the light of the world. He says, then I am the door. And then he goes on to say, as we'll read today, I am the good shepherd. Then he'll say after raising Lazarus, or right before raising Lazarus, I am the resurrection and the life. Then he'll tell his disciples in chapters 14 and 15, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and then I am the true vine. Right in the middle of all of those I am statements is what we're studying today, and I believe it's the most intimate and descriptive of all the different I am statements that Jesus makes about himself, because it not only reveals something about us, but it reveals how he feels about us. More so than saying, I'm the light of the world, saying, I am the good shepherd. It begins in chapter 10, verses 1 and 2. I tell you the truth. Anyone who sneaks over the wall of a sheepfold rather than going through the gate must surely be a thief and a robber. But the one who enters the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. Okay, so why does Jesus start with that kind of statement? He hasn't identified himself as the shepherd or a shepherd yet. He's talking about other entities, other people who are kind of trying to get at the sheep, but they're not a shepherd, not in charge of the sheep. They have a totally different agenda. What does he mean by that? Well, it picks up, if you skip from verse 2 to verse 6, Jesus could see that people didn't get it. So he tries to explain it to them. And it says, those who heard Jesus use this illustration didn't understand what he meant. So he explained it to them. I tell you the truth. All who come before me were thieves and robbers, but the true sheep
did not listen to them.
Yes, I am the gate. Those who come in through me will be saved. They will come and go freely and will find good pastures. The thief's purpose is to steal and kill and destroy. My purpose is to give them a rich and satisfying life. Okay, so Jesus is contrasting himself to this one that doesn't want to go through the gate and instead wants to hop over the fence to where the sheep are. And Jesus has bad ways of describing what their intentions are. They're here to steal, to rob, and even to murder and destroy. What's he talking about, and why does he use that to contrast himself against them? If you read early in chapter 6, if you're reading along, you may remember that as soon as Jesus performed the miracle of the loaves and fishes, where he took the 5 loaves and 2 fish and multiplied it so thousands of people could eat, the people wanted to elect him king, and Jesus withdrew and disappeared. Because he knows the kind of leader they want him to be. It's the kind of leader like this man, Judas of Galilee. You may have never heard of Judas of Galilee, but here's the interesting story about him. King Herod the Great, who was the king of Israel, kind of a puppet king backed by the Romans, is the one who had all the baby boys killed around Bethlehem when Jesus was born. The father of Judas of Galilee was executed by King Herod the Great. And that so hurt and angered Judas of Galilee that he spent the rest of his life trying to encourage a rebellion, trying to stir up and recruit people to overthrow the Romans and drive them out of Israel. In fact, we know from historical records outside of Scripture, 3 of his sons, Judas of Galilee, were killed during the Jewish-Roman War in the early 60s, where the Romans finally got tired of it, came down and squashed the Jewish rebellion, and they burned down the temple, and the rebels ran to Masada, and his 3 sons died during that uprising. Jesus is saying to them, look, I'm not like these other people who have ejected themselves into the social or political or religious life of Israel with an agenda that is not from my heavenly Father. And by the way, none of those persons actually fulfilled their promise. They didn't deliver on what their vision was for Israel. Everybody died as a result. Everybody lost things as a result. I'm not trying to lead people the way that they did. So Jesus contrasts himself as a very different kind of shepherd. You hear it emerging in verses 3 and 4 and 5. The gatekeeper opens the gate for him, and the sheep recognize his voice and come to him. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. After he has gathered his own flock, he walks ahead of him, and they follow him because they know his voice. They won't follow a stranger. They will run from him because they don't know his voice. If you read the whole of chapter 10, what you'll find is a progressive understanding or light bulbs going off in the mind of the crowd. They begin to understand that Jesus is calling them sheep and referring to himself as a shepherd. They receive this very unfavorably, and it's for 2 primary reasons. Number 1, they object based on religious terms. In the Old Testament, Israel was commonly called the sheep, and God, the God of Israel, was the shepherd. In fact, if you were to read Psalm 23 in the Hebrew, it wouldn't say the Lord is my shepherd or God is my shepherd in a general sense. It would say specifically Yahweh, the God of covenant, is our shepherd. And here's a human being, Jesus, who they don't understand as God in flesh, standing in front of them and saying, I'm your shepherd. They have a problem with that based on religious grounds. But secondly, I think perhaps more humanly, they reject just because he calls them sheep. It's not a compliment. If you have a friend that disagrees with the way that you're thinking about something, and they claim, you know what, you need to think for yourself. You're kind of, without thinking, following the influence of this other person. You're acting like a sheep. It's not a compliment. And while Jesus, I don't believe, is intending to insult them, the reality is they are. And here's why. They were much more acquainted with the nature of the animal husbandry and the raising of sheep than we are. In fact, Jesus is teaching this in the city of Jerusalem, in the temple courts. Here's a map of first century Israel, a topographical kind of map. And what you'll notice is there are two kind of parallel green lines or regions that run north to south. One of them is on the eastern side of the Jordan River, but one is on the western side of the Jordan River. And I've highlighted in red what is called the Central Plateau. It's about 35 miles long, 14 or 15 miles wide. It's the highlands. Jerusalem is at the very bottom. Bethel is at the very top. And in this area, the primary kind of form of agricultural economy was raising sheep. And the people in the first century, when Jesus says, "I am the shepherd and you are the sheep," they don't take that comparison very kindly. And that's because even back in Jesus' day, sheep were the most helpless of all the livestock that you could raise. They couldn't run away like some others. They couldn't defend themselves. They couldn't fly away like chickens. In fact, you may have seen this story back in 2022 in Mongolia. There was a Chinese sheep farmer who had a security camera because sheep are always susceptible to predators. And he captured this image. His sheep were walking around in a circle. It started as just a few and then others, and pretty soon it was almost the whole herd. They walked around in a circle, and there was no mechanism there like a machine that was guiding them that way. They weren't attached to anything. They were on their own accord walking in a circle for 12 days. And so animal experts began to, you know, kind of study this because it's almost spooky. I mean, it feels like a crop circle or something, like maybe this is where the aliens will land, you know, right in the middle of all these sheep. And what they discovered was basically just one sheep started following another one, and it created a domino effect until they were all just walking in a circle without stopping for 12 solid days. Sheep, to put it in the Greek, are kind of dumb. They really are. And they're the most vulnerable and helpless. Think about it. They're slow animals. They, you know, can't escape things very quickly. They're not very nimble. They're constantly getting themselves stuck in things, whether it's in caves or in ditches or even entangled in briars at times. They can get very, very fat with their wool growing out, and then it rains on their wool, and their wool gets super heavy, and they're even slower than they were before. They have zero individual defense mechanism, and they don't have strength in numbers. It's just a bigger buffet for the fox and for the wolf that's out there. They are not intelligent creatures. They're not. They will respond and begin moving off in directions without any memory of where they came from or how to get home. And sometimes that's just the wind blowing and making the sound through a tree, and it spooks them, and off they go. And then one goes, and then it triggers them. Sometimes it's one that's just looking for something else to eat, and they just wander around. Why is it that we don't find sheep in the wild? Because they can't survive. They're an easy target. You're beginning to understand why the people who would hear this might say, "Why is he speaking to us in this way? We are the religious leaders of Israel, and you're speaking to us as though we're sheep, and you are our shepherd." While it may be difficult for Jesus to say this and for us to accept it, I think he's right. Human beings, both collectively and individually, can be very sheep-like. Have you ever witnessed a video of a large sporting event where a stampede is triggered and there's not an immediate threat of something that should drive people out in that fashion? And yet people are injured, people are even killed, property is destroyed, and you're sitting back watching that thinking, "Everybody, would you just calm down? This doesn't make any sense. There's no need for you to do this. You're only making things worse." Because we can get into a herd mentality. If you're at a concert or even at a sporting event and you see a person next to you pull out their smartphone and turn on their flashlight, what do you immediately do? "Oh, should I be getting my phone out and turn on my flashlight? What are we doing again? I'm waving it now. I don't know what this is for." Take it from a historical perspective. We know this is true. When you were in middle school and you learned about the Nuremberg rallies in 1938, where the Germans were gathering as a people and rallying around the rise of Nazi leadership. And we look back anachronistically, historically, and think, how in the world could those people have agreed to get behind that agenda? How could they follow someone who was a political or religious or military leader who was so morally flawed? How did people support or at least turn a blind eye to such an unjust policy towards other human beings? Why didn't they think for themselves or speak up for others? And in his treatise, The Life of Reason, 1905, you know his quote well. George Santayana says, "Those who cannot remember the past are what? Condemned to repeat it." That we are not in 2025 immune, just collectively as human civilization, to group think like sheep. And it's individually true as well. I think about when I was in middle school, and there would be a new way of dressing, a new brand of clothing. I don't think it's that different in 2025. And I had to look like the group. Or bring it more closely. I love this description. Tim Keller kind of lays it out for us. When I think back about when I was 15 years old and I think about my 12-year-old self, I thought I was such a dork. I look back and I think, man, I can't believe I dressed like that. I can't believe I wore that to school. I can't believe I made a bad decision by sharing that secret with somebody else. I can't believe I didn't study more for that. I look back on my younger self with great criticism and dismissiveness. And it wasn't just from 15 to 12. It was from 18 to 15 and 21 to 18 and 25 to 18 and on about every 5 years until I finally turned 43, which I am now, and I've arrived. So Dr. Keller says, whatever age we are in life and look back on ourselves in the previous stage of life with scorn. What makes us like sheep is not that we outgrow our ignorance as we age, that's just part of it, but rather that we always think we're just now getting over it. As if when I am 48 or 53, I won't look back and say, you know, why did I make that purchase? Why did I invest there? Why didn't I invest in this relationship more? Why didn't I spend more time here? Why didn't I learn from that mistake? Why didn't I take better care of my body? Whatever it is, individually, we can be like sheep because we convince ourselves we're fine in the moment. At least I'm better than I used to be. Jesus Christ is not intending to insult the crowd in Jerusalem. He's not intending to insult you and me. But I think he does require us. There's no other way around it with Jesus. He absolutely requires us to tell the truth about ourselves, to ourselves. And if we reach deep down and we uncover who we really are and our motivations and all the things that we've done and said, we know that we can be like sheep. And oftentimes because we're listening to those other voices, whether it's the thief or the robber or the murderer who has hopped over the fence pin in an unauthorized way, or listening to the murmurings of the other sheep and then making decisions based on their opinions and judgments, or listening to the voice in our own head rather than the voice of the shepherd. Jesus is not just being critical. He now, in this portion of the chapter, turns and gives, in my opinion, one of the most beautiful passages and descriptions about his heart as the shepherd of the sheep. Verse 11, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd sacrifices his life for the sheep. A hired hand will run when he sees a wolf coming. He will abandon the sheep because they don't belong to him and he isn't their shepherd. And so the wolf attacks them and scatters the flock. The hired hand runs away because he's only working for the money. Doesn't really care about the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my own sheep and they know me. Just as my Father knows me and I know the Father, so I sacrifice my life for the sheep. I have other sheep too that are not in this sheepfold. I must bring them also. They will listen to my voice and there will be one flock with one shepherd. Jesus says in verse 14, I know my sheep, which means that whatever you are willing to admit about yourself to yourself, He already, prior to your admission of it, prior to your acknowledge of it, He already knew that about you. And what is He willing to do? Sacrifice His life for those ignorant, stupid, helpless sheep. And notice He doesn't say, as the shepherd, I'm always on my guard. Someone could sneak up and assassinate me, or someone could murder me against my will. No, no. I sacrifice my life. He says in another place in John, no one takes my life from me. I lay it freely down. Why? Because despite all the bad qualities of sheep, we are incredibly valuable to the shepherd. And He closes in that last sentence with something very telling. They will listen to my voice, and there will be one flock with one shepherd. You know, my understanding of sheep, I don't have direct, experience in farming sheep, but in what I see, it's mostly a very Western way of dealing with sheep, like in Great Britain or in Ireland or Scotland or maybe Australia or even here in the U.S. And because sheep are so without direction and so disorganized and so chaotic and frantic and all this, how do you get the sheep to go where you need for them to go? You have a sheep dog, or you use equipment or even drones in the 21st century to direct these animals. They are motivated by threat and fear. And if they don't go wherever that thing is behind them that's driving them, they feel like they're going to get eaten up. Jesus says, they will listen to my voice. And over 5 times in this verse, He says, my voice will lead them. He's not behind driving, pushing, coercing, and threatening. He's out in front summoning. Where to? Cool pasture, green pastures, cool waters, back to the safety of the pen where He will lay across the gate at night, sacrificing His own life for the sake of the sheep. Friends, once you know the truth about yourself and admit it to yourself, and you simultaneously know the truth about the shepherd, that truth will set you free. I'm just curious if you would think for a second about the voices that you've listened to that weren't His. There are a lot of thieves out there. I've seen it time and again, as have you, even sometimes religious thieves come in an unauthorized way, not through the gate, not through the fulfillment of the messianic prophecies as Jesus was. They come to steal and kill and destroy. You might be listening to the voice of other sheep. You might be listening to the voice inside your own head, which is telling you that ultimately your purpose, your happiness, your fulfillment will be in career or financial fulfillment. That's a powerful voice. But there's another. Doesn't threaten, doesn't drive, doesn't coerce, but it's out in your future summoning, come. The shepherd is good and kind and protective. And when you listen to that voice, it can absolutely transform your self-understanding, not as a worthless, foolish sheep, but as a valuable sheep that belongs in His fold. There's a beautiful image of this past Tuesday night. I took my son to see Les Mis on Broadway. It's my favorite musical. And one of the things I gave him for Christmas was the two of us going to that together. I saw it, and he attended it back in December of 2007 when he was about 4 months along in his mom's tummy. And we went to see it on Broadway in New York City before our first child was born. If you know the story, you know the primary character is a character named Valjean. It's set in the 1820s to 1840s, kind of within that time frame. And he's a French man who, as the story opens, has been convicted as a felon for stealing bread. And he's serving 19 years in hard labor, rowing on boats, shackled in chains, very, very grueling, difficult work. He had stolen the bread to feed the child of his sister, who was at the point of starvation. After breaking the law, he was sentenced. Finally, in the story as it begins, he is set on parole. And Valjean, marked as a criminal, makes his way from those shackles in the imprisonment to a new set of shackles in the world, when he finds very quickly that no one wants anything to do with him, that when he can find work, he is paid far less than those who don't have a criminal record, and he is despised and rejected and cast out. On one night, after being shorted on the money that he had been owed for the work, he was bitter and angry and left without shelter until there in the street, out from a home, a door opens up with warmth of a fire in the background and candles and a welcoming table. Out walks a bishop, a religious leader who sees him and has mercy upon him and approaches him and says, "Come in, brother. You are welcome in our home. You are welcome at this table. Eat as much as you want." Valjean, with some trepidation, enters into the home, sits down at the table, and begins to feed himself. He gorges himself. And as the meal is concluded, the bishop says, "I am retiring for the evening. You are welcome to stay in this bed until morning." And as soon as the bishop withdraws to his bedroom and closes the door, Valjean begins this kind of internal soliloquy. And he says, "That man's a fool. He tried to help me as something good and something merciful to do, but he left me with all of this silver. I can take these candlesticks, I can take all of this cutlery, all of this fine metal and silver, and it's worth twice what I could earn in a couple of days of work. I'm out of here." And he collects the belongings and he goes. He's caught by the authorities, tracked down by law enforcement. They recognize where he's been, they associate it back with the bishop, and so they bring him back in the middle of the night with torches and they throw him on the ground. He's in shackles again. They summon and wrestle the bishop from his sleep and bring him out and explain, "We found this man with your belongings and we brought him back so that you can press charges against him and we'll throw him back in the slammer where he belongs." And the bishop says, "Oh no, he didn't tell you a lie. Those actually were a gift from me to him. In fact, friend, you left too early. I intended for you to take these too." And he goes and collects even more precious silver and brings them to Valjean and then turns to those who had arrested him and says, "So, Monsieur, you may release him, for this man has spoken truth." Can we have this slide, please? "For this man has spoken true. I commend you for your duty, and God's blessing go with you." Those who arrested him are a little bit caught off guard by this, but they take the man at his word and they recede into the background. And the bishop and Valjean are left. And the bishop knelt down in this play and got one foot from his face and said, "But remember this, my brother, see in this some higher plan. You must use this precious silver to become an honest man." Now pause. It occurred to me, if he would have gone along with the story of Valjean, if he would have said, "Oh yeah, I gave him this, you can go back to your other work, thank you very much, but the man, I'm not going to press charges," they could have left and he could have turned to Valjean and said, "Okay, scumbag, fork it over. I'm keeping that which you stole from me. I'm just not going to press charges. Now get out." That would have been an expression of mercy, but no. He wants to speak with a different voice into this man's life and says, "By the witness of the martyrs, by the passion and the blood, God has raised you out of darkness. I have bought your soul for God." And at this point in the play, he has cradled the man's face in his hands and looked deep into his eyes and spoke those powerful words. And it is disruptive for Valjean. The bishop stands and goes back into his home, and Valjean is left with his own thoughts and his tortured sense of identity. Is it possible that for all those terrible things that I've done and the label of criminal, of evil, of a bad person that had been put on me, is it possible that there's an alternative to all of that? And he believes that voice of the bishop, and he totally changes his life. And he becomes an honest man, eventually working his way up to being the mayor of a small town, the foreman over a large factory. He cares for his workers. He helps those who are hurting. He manages it with justice and prudence. And even when one of the employees in the factory, a woman, a single mother with a child who lives elsewhere, when she gets injured and she is dying, he pledges to go and get her child and to raise her as his own, which he does. And the rest of his life is the story of redemption. And at his deathbed, he's gathered there to his side his daughter Cosette, her new husband Marius, whose life Valjean had saved. And Valjean is asking, he's expressing his love for her, and he's asking for God to be merciful. And then he breathes his last and he dies. And as soon as he does, the stage is completely dark except for a single light that is cast down upon him on the bed. And he somehow, with all the different creative ways of live production, he's able to kind of make his way out of the bed even as a ghost and begin to move backwards. And then you hear this choir begin to sing. And from the shadows in the back of the stage move forward all the other virtuous people in the production who have died. They are the heavenly choir as characters in their garb to welcome him home. I had seen that in 2007 in New York. I had seen it in movies. I had seen it in other productions. But this one last Tuesday, I did something unique. As they're beginning that beautiful song and welcoming him into heaven, you see a figure begin to weave through the crowd from the very back of the stage, and into the light steps the bishop. And he sees Valjean, and his face has a huge smile, and his arms are wide, and he wraps him up and holds him firmly as he walks him into heaven. Can I ask you, friends, can you hear the voice of the shepherd in your life? All of us have other voices. All of us have listened to other voices. But there's only one. There's only one voice that is willing to lay down his life so that you can forever in life and the life to come be led beside still waters, be led to feed in green pastures, and be protected. His voice is worth listening to. Heavenly Father, today we thank you for the life of your Son, Jesus. And we thank you, Lord, that his voice was not just present during his 3 years of earthly ministry, but he promised his disciples that he would pour out his Spirit, the same inner life that led him in his ministry. He would pour out his Spirit upon them so that he would not be ever more than just a breath away from them, to guide them, protect them. We ask, Lord, for you to speak with the voice of your Spirit into our lives this day, that we may know and respond to the good, good shepherd.
The church at Rossbridge is located in Birmingham, Alabama, and helps people find abundant life in Jesus Christ.